This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9.
It's Wednesday the 14th of June. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Shannon Power.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
I'm Shannon Power, your host on tonight's Informer.
And I'm Saramza. And on tonight's show, we cross to Uganda, where we hear from the founder of Uganda's LGBTI Film Festival, and to find out why he risked his own life to run the country's only LGBTI event.
And later on, we'll hear from two women who sought asylum in Australia after being forced to flee their home country because they are lesbians.
But first, we're going to take a look at the changes to the Native Title Act, which have just passed the Federal Parliament. Earlier today, controversial amendments to the Native Title Act were passed with the support of the major parties. Only the Greens voted against the proposed changes.
Essentially, the changes mean that companies wanting to get an Indigenous Land Use Agreement, or ILUA, would need to get the permission of only a majority of traditional owners. Before today's changes, companies would have to get the unanimous consent of all traditional owners of the land on which they hope to do business.
Critics of the changes said the government was pandering to the interests of the Adani family, who want to open the controversial Carmichael coal mine in Queensland. Currently, the ILUA for the Adani mine is held up in the federal court challenged by traditional owners.
Last week, Australia's leading experts came together in Townsville to attend the biennial National Native Title Conference. One of those attending was Jeffrey Winters. He's the director of Indigenous Law at the firm Chalk and Barnhart, and he's also the interim chair of the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. Jeffrey joins us now on The Informer to discuss those changes to the Native Title laws. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us on Joy. Just give us an idea, as someone who practices in the Native Title sector, what do these changes mean to people who might not really understand the nuances of the law?
Good evening, Shannon, and thanks for having me. Well, the first thing you've got to understand is this. The legislation was absolutely and is without apology by the government a reaction to a federal court decision late last year. The McGlade decision, which was handed down by the full federal court, effectively invalidated a decision to authorise an ILUA, which you've explained in your introduction piece, based on the fact that the full authorisation meeting hadn't taken place. Now, as you've correctly identified, previously the Act did require that the full applicant group, to the Native Title determination unanimously agree before the particular type of ILUA that was in that case could become binding. What this legislation does is effectively amend the mechanisms provided for in the Native Title Act whereby an ILUA can become authorised. Yes, it does in some circumstances mean that only half of the group will be sufficient, a standard majority vote to get it up. However, and what has been missed in some of the coverage today, the provisions do also provide that the applicant group, in the terms of their constitution of the group that's constituted, the corporation that is, by the traditional owners to make these decisions, to have another mechanism in place. Therefore, they could require a 75% or a full majority if they chose to, but the resting position of the law now is, as correctly identified, back to 50% required to get the thing through as a base starting point.
So just to be clear, various Aboriginal corporations around Australia can determine themselves how much of that percentage they would require for an ILUA to be approved.
So what takes place is that you get a group of applicants who are the parties to a Native Title application. The state, wherever the Native Title land is majority, is usually the other side of the litigation. When the determination comes into effect and we have what is the determined Native Title right, That group, the applicant group, ceased to exist, and a prescribed body corporate, Representative Native Title Corporation, is registered on a register held by the Commonwealth. That group is vested, or that corporation is vested with the exercising of the rights the Native Title group holds. Now, that group, like any other corporation historically, could set the terms and rules upon which decisions are made, much like BHP or Foxtel or Ten, for example, News Limited, can set the terms upon which their board can make decisions. In the past, yes, it was a requirement that a whole group unanimous decision was made. That was the statutory standard. Now the statutory standard is that it can be as small as 50%. However, yes, the group does have the ability to ensure that there is a higher threshold or an alternative decision-making mechanism in place.
Where do you stand personally on these changes? Do you think that it's the right move to make these kind of changes, or is it better the way that it was from yesterday?
Well, you've got to understand the whole spirit and purpose of the Ilua mechanism. The whole spirit and purpose of providing for Indigenous land use agreements is to enable native title holders to enter into activity, joint ventures or other proposed ventures that enable them to economically realise the potential of the native title interest they hold. Native title is a very difficult interest to turn into anything tangible to start with. And so when these opportunities do come along, it's already often at the result of a very difficult and protracted process. I think, as a starting point, we should enable native title holders as many opportunities as possible to realise the economic potential of their interests and to lead to economic development in their communities, because we all surely must agree that sustainable, independent and healthy economic communities in the Indigenous space is what the whole nation aspires to. I think it's a reasonable view to say that you want to put safeguards and measurements in place. But you've got to understand that the reason these amendments came onto the table was that the decision brought a whole number of activities into question, activities and decisions that had already been made and which communities had assumed they were operating on. Now, the legislation, I think, is slightly being beat up, and I don't want to be partisan about it at all. The Labor Party deliberately delayed the process because they thought there was need for more consultation, and that was very fair. Unfortunately, in the intervening period, there's been a significant narrative built around this being about the Adani instance specifically. Now, whichever major controversial Ilua was going before the Federal Native Title Registry at any given time in history when this debate came up would have been the subject of huge controversy and suspicion. It just happens to be at this time it's the Adani one. I think anybody who views it through that prism is being slightly or overly cynical. I think it strikes the balance fairly. It enables Aboriginal people still to control their economic destiny, and it even more so enables flexibility and certainty around those communities who want to engage in economic activity without the sorts of precarious situations that can arise. And I'll make this one analogy, which I think particularly to the listenership of this program they'll understand. Take major community groups such as LBG community groups, or whether it's the Mardi Gras organisation in Sydney, for example. We're always tied between trying to represent the views of absolutely everyone in that community and with getting on with the jobs they're tasked to perform. This is the exact same tension that you're seeing playing out here in the native title space. You want to give credence to everyone in the community's view, because particularly in the native title space, they have an extremely legitimate claim to having a contribution. But at the same time, you've got to balance that with the imperative of trying to get on, achieve outcomes and deliver for the community. So it's not a straightforward, easy answer, but I think these amendments are mechanical and provide for a fair balance, and I think any of the beat up around it is slightly cynical and unnecessary.
Right. Okay. Geoffrey Winters, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us on the Native Title Act changes, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you, Shannon. Bye.
Bye.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We'd love to hear from you about of any of tonight's topics, so send us an SMS on 0427 joy949 or email onair@joy.org.au or tweet us at The Informer Joy.
Now we head over to Uganda, where even though the government signed an anti-gay bill in 2015, LGBTI people defy the risk of violence to raise the visibility of their community. Kamoka Hassan founded Uganda's first LGBTI Film Festival. The Queer Kampala Film Festival launched last year, and to protect filmgoers, the screenings locations were kept secret until the last minute.
Not content with just raising the Uganda's LGBTI's community visibility, Hassan wants to use the Queer Kampala Film Festival to also help other LGBTI filmmakers across Africa. Kamoka Hassan joins us on the line from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
I wanted to ask, can you give us an idea of what life is like for LGBTI people in Uganda?
Well, in Uganda, up to date, gay people don't have the freedom to be who they are. Like, newspapers are still outing people. In some rare instances, we have our friends who have actually been arrested simply because of who they are. Though we don't have a law in place, but then the situation on the ground is not okay for an ordinary gay man in Uganda today. Yeah, if you remember so well, in 2014, the Ugandan president signed what was called the Kill the Gay Bill internationally. But then due to the international pressure and criticism, the death sentence was actually reduced to life imprisonment. So even the kind of work that we are doing in Uganda is illegal. It's not allowed by the government.
You run the Queer Kampala International Film Festival. Give us an idea of why you started this film festival.
The reason why we started this film festival, first of all, gay people in Uganda don't have like their own media spaces. Like, the media has been accusing us that we are recruiting children. They have been accusing us of spreading HIV and then even being terrorists. But we want to change people's mindsets using film. The idea of the festival came about last year, but then before we did the festival, we had actually worked on a film called Outed, The Painful Reality. This was a film that was talking about the consequences of being outed in a homophobic country like Uganda. So when we released this film, we showed it to the general Ugandan audience, but we did screenings like in secret places because we didn't want the police to come and attack the event. Mm-hmm. And then we saw that film was a very powerful medium to change people's mindsets, and this is how the idea of the festival came about. So we had our first edition last year in December. The festival ran for like 3 days. It was the first public queer film festival to be held in Uganda. At first, we expected to get like 3,000 people, but then in total for 3 days, we got like 836 people.
Wow.
Which was still a big deal, you know? Yes, because in the same year, the police had actually raided the Pride event in Uganda. So there was a lot of fear that the police could actually come and attack our event. But then to our surprise, people still came up, and it was really a huge success.
That's fantastic.
So we hope this, yeah.
Why do you think so many people did turn up, even amid the security fears?
The people we got, they were not only coming from the LGBTI community, but then we also got people who are outside our queer family. Most of the people who came to the festival wanted to know what it means to be queer, and they wanted to learn about our lives and all that. And then to the people who are part of our queer family, the films that we actually screened were about them. So it was a way of passing on a message, because they wanted to show the people out there that, hey, look, we exist. And then we also had like debates, which acted like eye-openers to the people who didn't really understand us. So most of the people actually wanted to get educated about what it means to be queer.
You did have to undergo a lot of security measures, like, you know, keeping venues secret, to keep it a secret from police. Just talk us through what you have to do to protect the people coming to your film festival.
Well, we used a lot of social media, but then for our communication on phone, we didn't actually use Ugandan numbers. We were using actually a Canadian number, and people could actually send us messages on WhatsApp to tell us that they were interested to come to the festival. But then we could actually screen them and ask them like some basic questions about why they wanted to attend the event. So from the answers we could get, we could tell who was actually homophobic and who was someone who was actually just willing to come and learn and be part of the festival. Though this was a hectic work, like to screen people, it was really sad that there are people who we actually didn't get to come and be part of the event because they were very homophobic. But then in future we want to actually to attract more people, not only people from the LGBTI community. But at the moment, we can't go public. We'll still hold it as a kind of a secret event because the police and the authority, they are still very hostile when it comes to LGBTI gatherings in Uganda.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy. We are speaking with Kamoko Hassan, who is the festival director of the Queer Kampala International Film Festival in Uganda. Now, Kamoko, you're a very, active activist in Uganda. Do you ever worry about your own safety while running this film festival?
Well, first of all, I must say that I consider myself as an ordinary person who is just doing the right thing, though people have actually labeled me as an activist. But then to me, I feel that if I don't fight, even me, myself, I'm not going to be safe in my own country. So I don't believe, to me, being silent is not very healthy. We have to speak about these injustices. There are times when I worry about my own life, but then I can't just go silent when these injustices are happening. Mm. I know it's a very risky fight, and I always tell people around me, or like people are doing like similar things, that we may not be the right people to complete this kind of work that we have started. But then when we keep on pushing, we are actually making it easier for ourselves and for the next generation of queer people who are going to come before us. So to me, I don't believe in going silent.
Mm. So you're at the moment trying to raise funds for the next film festival in Uganda, which will be happening in December. And you've just spoken about not staying silent and trying to make things better for the next generation of queer people. How do you think the film festival helps to reduce discrimination and promote understanding of the LGBTI community?
First of all, when people see pictures, like when we use pictures and sound, it's very easier for us to pass on the message. I know this is a new way of activism because we have tried out so many things, and I'm not trying to take away the credit of all the other people who are doing like different things in their own capacities to change the situation. But to me, I believe film is a voice, and through film we can change people's mindsets, and we can get people to get to understand us when they watch films.
You are looking to raise money to run the next film festival in December. Just give us an idea. Do you rely solely on fundraising? Do you get any sponsorship? Or unless people donate, the film festival won't run. Is that how it works?
First of all, we are the only queer event in Uganda that happens, but we don't charge people money to come and be part of all our events. We absolutely charge nothing. But then we pay for venues where we can actually have these film screenings. And then we also pay for the technical, like hiring equipment and all this. But then in Uganda, we don't have like any local support. even local companies can't support the work that we are doing because they are against what we are doing. So we rely mostly on people's generosity, most especially people from outside Uganda. Mm. So we have actually launched an online campaign where people can actually donate whatever amount that they have. You know, it could be like $5 or $10. Mm. Every little bit helps.
I guess the fact that you don't have commercial support within Uganda, you're paying for everything yourself, but also the fact that you've seen changes in the community from running a film festival, I think really reinforces how important it is to help by donating. Mm-hmm. Just let us know, where can people go to find the fundraising page for them to be able to donate to the Queer Kampala International Film Festival?
We have a website. It's www.queerkif.com. Queerkif is written as, it's written as www, then Q U E R K I F F .com. It will take you to our Indiegogo campaign.
And how much money are you looking to raise to be able to run this year's film festival?
We are looking at raising $35,000. This money is going to help us like rent like 5 venues in Kampala. We are also looking at bringing other queer filmmakers from other African countries where it is actually criminalized to be queer, because part of our goal is to also listen to other people who are coming from similar situations, and maybe we can find like a global solution to what is affecting our queer family. Mm. So we shall have guests from outside Uganda, and this money will actually help us like book for their accommodation, pay for their local transport, and then we are also going to be able like to give awards to the outstanding film. The reason why we want to give awards this year, this is actually going to encourage more people to make such queer films, because at the moment we have few Africans who are actually telling their own stories through their own images. So we also plan to have workshops where we can actually invite people who have knowledge about filmmaking. And then the money we are going to raise will actually facilitate all these things. And it is absolutely going to be free to all the people in Uganda and from other regions around Africa.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9's Nightly News and Current Affairs show, The Informer. My name is Shannon Power. We've had a bunch of new members renew and sign up during our radiothon this month, and I'm going to run through the very long list because I'm super chuffed they've signed up during The Informer. I want to say thank you to Damien from Windsor, Ian from Aberfeldy, Craig from Woodend, Rochen from Brunswick East, Noah from Yarraville, Claire from Newport, Angelica from Newport, Russell from Croydon, Meredith from Elstonwick, Bradley from Paran, and Oz from Kurrinjang. So that's a nice mix of suburbs. Thank you so much. You can support Joy as well, because we still need Joy. Head to joy.org.au and renew or sign up as a member. Now, we were supposed to play a third story for you about the Stories of Hope exhibition, which is all about refugees and asylum seekers in Australia. It's happening at Federation Square on June 20, but I didn't want to cut the story down. So we'll play that for you tomorrow night because we have run out of time. I really wanted to do that story justice. Renee and her partner, Tina's story of them fleeing their home country to come to Australia to escape their home country because they're queer is just really, really amazing. So tune in to The Informer tomorrow night from 6:30 to talk about that. I want to thank my co-host Suri from The Taste of Radio course, or Joy Radio Training. How did you find your first night on The Informer?
deadly.
Well, that ties in very nicely to the fact that you're also one of the team members from Urban Dreaming, which is
I'm actually the anchor of Urban Dreaming.
Oh,
yes.
Wow, you've been you've kicked out Miscellaneous, have you?
And you've taken me and Miscellaneous, we were always in that sort of category, I guess, with each other.
Oh, very nice. You share nicely.
But what she's always travelling, and it's got to that point where
that's on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. What is Urban Dreaming for the uninitiated?
So Urban Dreaming is basically crossing two worlds. So the black and the white, traditional, contemporary, gay and straight, basically. Creating the platform through the arts medium as well, and interviews with people of the likes, and crossing, making that bridge, basically.
Fantastic.
Making the bridge together.
And you run like a really interesting show. What are some of the fun segments on Urban Dreaming?
We talk a bit of language.
Yeah, cool.
So we teach a word a day. And we also, I guess, when we do have fun, we've actually just starting up with Missy's Box coming up. So that'd be her corresponding from Darwin.
Oh, cute.
And she'll have a celebrity segment for 5 minutes with us as well, which, so she's not leaving the show, just so you know. And, I guess we're still developing, really, but we've we've always got quite controversial sort of conversations as well.
Yeah, yeah, you cover the whole breadth. What was last night's word, just out of curiosity?
Last night's word was Gadia, meaning white fella.
Oh, fantastic. What country is that from?
So that's out from the Kimberley and the Pilbara region.
There you go. Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us on The Informer. You can listen to Urban Dreaming Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. on Joy. But that's it for another episode of The Informer tonight.
Awesome. And yes, we'd like to thank tonight's guest as well. That was Jeffrey Winters and Kamoka Hassan. And we'd like to also thank our extended Informer team, including our panellist Corey. Well done, Corey, for utting tonight's, putting together the show, actually. And my name is Saramza, and thank you guys for tuning in.
Platform, I'm Shannon Power.
Breaking news, time is running out. Joy's Radiothon is coming to a close. Don't miss out on your chance to win amazing prizes and to support Joy before June 30. Head to joy.org.au now.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.